meeting, Thursday the 24th of May. However, we will open on a future Thursday, likely next Thursday, for consideration of several bills. The chairman would at this time reschedule Senate Bill 188 for the following Thursday. It's ordered. We will move also House Bill 2716, Senate Bill 67, also forward to the following Thursday. And that will be at the approval of the Senate President. It's ordered. Today we have on our bills, or on our agenda, several bills to consider. And the first of which will be Senate Bill 61. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 61. The chair will entertain a motion to move Senate Bill 61 to the Committee for Public Affairs.
So move.
Mr. Vice Chair, thank you very much. Vice Chair moves Senate Bill 61 to the Committee on Public Affairs. Your view.
You didn't do that yesterday?
We did not do that yesterday. We do need to amend the bill,
Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, with your permission, I withdraw that motion.
The motion to move the Senate Bill 61 to Public Affairs is withdrawn. So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I would move the -4 amendments to Senate Bill 61.
The Vice Chair moves the -4 amendments to Senate Bill 61 without objection. So ordered. Vice Chair?
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 61 to the Committee on Public Affairs.
Public Affairs, yes, exactly. without objection? So ordered. Work session on Senate Bill 61 is closed.
Boy, your work was easy this morning. What's next?
Let's work Senate Bill 2281, or House Bill 2281,
please. Chair,
thank you, Mr. Warner. A quick orientation to the workings of the bill.
A couple of things on House Bill 2281, which you've had two public hearings on. The first is that the first thing is that we did calibrate our revenue impact estimate to the May 15 forecast. So you have a little bit different revenue estimate from your original bill that you looked at your last public hearing. And it actually reduced the revenue impact because the corporate income tax forecast is down about 10% actually in the out years. So it had the net effect of when we incorporated the economic feedback effect from OTIM to reduce general fund revenue by $98.4 million in the 2003-05 biennium, and $102.4 million in the 2005-07 biennium. That was compared to $109 million in 2003-05 in the previous estimate. So you have a revised impact there. You also have a -4 amendment, A4, which allows a selection for telecommunications and utilities of taxpayers in those industries. The definitions there follow what we call the NAICS, which is the North American Industrial Classification System, and that's where those definitions come from. Taxpayers that fit into those categories have an option of staying with the current 50% sales factor or using the 100% sales factor for if they so choose. The impact of that on revenue is to reduce revenue further and make the revenue impact bigger We're estimating that in '03, '05, and this is taking the '98 corporate income tax returns and extrapolating them forward, that the A4 amendments would reduce revenue by $2.9 million in '03, '05, and by $3.4 million in '05, '07. So if you incorporate those marginal changes, I have a revenue impact for the A4, shows that general fund revenue is $101.3 million, down in '03, '05, and in '05, '07, general fund is reduced by $105.8 million. So that would be the revenue impact associated with the A4.
Questions from the committee? We're in work session on House Bill 2281.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Vice Chair.
Move the A4 amendments to House Bill 2281.
The Vice Chair moves the A4 amendments to House Bill 2281. Questions? Objections to the motion? Ordered.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Vice Chair.
Move House Bill 2281 to the floor with a due pass.
The motion is for House Bill 2281 to go to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Are there any questions on the motion? Objections? Hearing and seeing them so ordered. Do we have a volunteer to carry this good bill? Vice Chair will carry. So ordered. Colleagues, I need to regress for just a minute here. Mr. Vice Chairman, you moved Senate Bill 61 to the floor. Was that with the due pass as amended?
61 was to the Medicaid Committee.
I'm sorry, move that to the Public Affairs Committee. And was that a due pass as amended? Colleagues, you need to suspend the rules and add the recommendation of the committee to the order.
Doesn't make a difference.
Apparently, Kim indicates it does make a difference, and she's our ever-watchful.
I need a recommendation of due pass as amended or without.
Oh, okay.
And we can actually send it without recommendation if that's your preference, or due pass.
No.
Okay. All right, so we need a motion to we have to reopen the work session on Senate Bill 61. Chair will accept a motion to suspend the rules for the purpose of designating the committee's recommendation on Senate Bill 61. Without objection? Ordered. Vice Chair moves the due pass as amended be the recommendation added to the committee. Any objections from the committee?
Sure.
Senator Minnis.
As I was out of the room, tell me what your amendment was.
The amendment was the dash A4 amendments.
We discussed yesterday.
I have a question.
Question.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Am I going to be considered a absent vote on 2281, or can I open the record to vote no?
We can reconsider the bill if you wish.
Well, my first question is, am I considered a vote on it? I was in the room, but it was at the time you were doing it. Just doing the vote.
Yeah, I did the, actually I did the vote without objection.
Right.
Senator Corcoran, if you'd like to register your objection, we can certainly do that.
I would.
Okay. Bill, actually, let's reopen the work session on House and Senate Bill 61. We're under rule suspension to consider it for the recommendation. I'd have to ask for suspension of the rules to reconsider the bill. Any objections?
So moved.
Hearing and seeing none? Ordered. We're under reconsideration for Senate Bill 61. The motion that was made on Senate Bill 61 was to amend in the dash 4 amendments and to move the bill with the due pass recommendation as amended to the Public Affairs Committee. Questions? I need a motion to...
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 61 as amended to the Committee on Public Affairs with a due pass recommendation.
Clerk will call the roll.
We're voting on
61
to the Public Affairs Committee.
Move it to the Public Affairs.
Oh, aye.
Aye.
No.
Aye.
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 Motion passes. Thank you. Thank you, colleagues. Okay, we are now in the consideration. We have, I think, concluded our business on 2281.
Did you want
to reopen? Senator Torkin, did you wish to have consideration of House Bill 2281 reopened for recording of your vote, we did that also without objection, and I believe you were in the room.
I so request.
I need a rule suspension to reconsider.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator.
I would move that the rules be suspended for the purpose of allowing Senator Corcoran to record his vote on House Bill 2281.
Objections? Any seeing none? So ordered. Senator Corcoran, how do you vote on 2281?
No.
Senator Corcoran will be referred as a no on 2281. So ordered. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2381 and move to House Bill 3391. We have a couple of folks that have signed up to testify for House Bill 3391, so I'd like to call appropriate staff person forward to give the committee a brief orientation for the bill. Morning, Ed.
Morning, Mr. Chair.
And then we will call for some folks from the Treasury and proponents of the bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3391A increases the income tax credit available for donations to fiduciary organizations administering individual development accounts. The maximum credit amount is increased under the bill from $25,000 or 25% of amounts donated under current law to $50,000 or 50% of amounts donated. This change would apply beginning 2002 tax year.
Any questions on the orientation? Can we have Kate Richardson and Michael Parker from the Treasury step forward, please, and educate the committee?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Kate Richardson, Oregon State Treasury, and I'm here to speak to the Dash A5 amendments, which I understand you should have before you.
We do have.
All right.
The A5 amendment?
There's an A3 and an A5 in here. Actually, A3, A4, and A5.
I don't have A4. I mean, I don't have A5.
I don't have A5.
Fresh off the press.
If I may.
Please proceed.
I'm here on behalf of the State Treasurer and Treasury. We fully support the Dash A5 amendments to House Bill 3391, and these amendments relate to the Oregon College Savings Plan. And we're excited to see that the IDA program, Individual Development Account program, can be expanded to include the College Savings Plan. This bill is important. These amendments are important because it allows more Oregonians access to a college education. As you know, the College Savings Plan is new, and in just 5 months, we've enjoyed great success. We have over more than 4,000 participants, and $10 million has already been contributed into it. Making the College Savings Plan more available to a wider spectrum of Oregonians is one of the top goals of the Treasurer and of the Qualified Tuition Savings Board. And this bill would do that. It would allow greater access to lower and moderate income Oregonians who often have a difficult time saving. It would allow them greater access to a college education by providing a bigger incentive to save for college. And we hope that the committee will support these amendments. And if you have questions about the technical parts to it, Michael Parker, the Executive Director of the Oregon College Savings Plan, is here to answer those.
Good morning. There's a Dash 4 amendment and a Dash 5 amendment. The Chair understands that there's a technical error in Dash 4.
Mr. Chair,
explain that, not in great detail, but slowly and distinctly for the benefit of the committee.
Sure, Mr. Chair. Again, for the record, my name is Michael Parker, Executive Director of the Oregon College Savings Plan. The Dash A4 amendments actually were in conflict with federal law because under the Oregon College Savings Plan and Internal Revenue Code 529, you cannot jointly own a college savings plan account, and that was a technical problem within the A4s. We broke that out to allow for two accounts to be owned under the A5s, where an individual would own the account and the IDA would own a separate account in conjunction. They would both work in conjunction together instead of being a joint account. So the technical problem was that you can't have joint ownership in an account.
Okay. Otherwise, there would be no problem with having a conflict with federal law. At least for the chairs. The Dash A3s? Did you wish to engage the committee on discussion of the A3 amendments?
Mr. Chair, no. It's just the A4s and A5s are the only ones that relate to the Oregon College Savings Plan.
Further questions from the committee? Senator Mann?
Just a brief thumbnail sketch of how this plan works, or will work under the bill.
Go ahead.
Oh, Mr. Chair, Representative Minnis, Senator Minnis, how it would work is an IDA, an individual who is going to work with an IDA organization.
With a what?
With an individual development account organization.
Individual development
account organization. Which is the IDA, which is called the fiduciary organization or a nonprofit organization. There would be a contract set up between the individual and the IDA organization. If the individual wishes to save for college, they have the option to invest in the Oregon College Savings Plan. They would be putting their own money into their own account for a designated beneficiary. Then the IDA would also put money in a separate account for that same beneficiary. And the reason the College Savings Plan is being offered because there's a tax break once you get the higher returns available under the College Savings Plan. So those two plans would grow together, and at the time of distribution, the individual would use his or her account first. Then the IDA account would kick in after you've used up your own assets.
How do you form an IDA?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, there's folks here from the Enterprise Foundation that are able to speak to that, how to form an IDA.
Let's bring forward Mr. Ball. Thank you very much for your testimony. Senator Minnis, I think Mr. Ball can answer your question.
Mr. Chair, distinguished senators, my name is, for the record, Robert Bull with the Enterprise Foundation in Portland, Oregon, and we're a nonprofit agency that works with the state around individual development accounts. And so, very quickly, we urge you to support House Bill 3391 and the two amendments associated with that. Last legislative session, this body saw fit to move forward on the Oregon IDA program, the IDA tax credit program, to incent corporations and private individuals to contribute to IDAs. What we had found, and then the state the next year, 2000, asked us to take up as a fiduciary organization for this state program to market the tax credit. And what we found was that the incentive as contained in the original tax credit was not enough to incent corporate involvement in this, so we've come back working with Representatives Westland and Representative Merkley to increase the amounts of the tax credit. And then also to increase the functionality of this in working with the Oregon College Savings Program. So I think that we've spoken before about this, and there's some interest in it, so I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Menace has a question.
I'm just a little dense, so you said that corporations and private persons?
Indeed. There's
Hang on a second. They can form an IDA, correct?
No, sir.
Okay. Who can form an IDA?
There are two sides of this equation. A corporation and an individual could contribute money as a charitable contribution to a nonprofit IDA program.
Is the IDA like a middleman?
The IDA is a tool used by nonprofit organizations around the state to work with low-income individuals. And so currently money for IDAs has come from philanthropy. We've had about $1 million by Meyer Memorial Trust and other people, plus the federal government. This is a new source of funding for
okay. those. Give me one of these. Who's on first things?
Yeah.
Nonprofit organization. Any nonprofit organization?
Any nonprofit organization.
Any nonprofit 501c3?
That serves low-income individuals.
That serves low-income individuals. They can form an IDA.
They can start IDA accounts.
Under the legislation passed in 1999. Is that correct?
Exactly.
All right. And then they can solicit contributions from corporations and or private persons to go into
that
two different accounts to benefit a particular individual, correct?
Exactly.
All right. And the two different accounts under this -5 amendment, you've got a personal account in the name of the person who's the beneficiary. You have a secondary account that is in the name of who?
Let me actually step back for that for a second. The IDA account, as it's set up, is a match savings account where an individual saves money in a bank account, a savings account at a bank.
So I'm the individual. I'm posing the benefit from this. I want to go to college.
You start to save from or home ownership or starting a business. You save money in a bank account that is designated an IDA account.
Okay.
Every dollar that you save for a period of time is matched at some rate. So So let's say your IDA account is for 2 years, and you can save $1,000 a year, and it's going to be matched one-to-one. So at the end of a two-year period, you save $2,000. It will be matched out of a nonprofit escrow account at $2,000. So there are indeed two accounts. One is held by the nonprofit, and the IDA match money does not actually go to the individual, ever. It goes to the bursar at the school, or it goes to the escrow agent for the home. So the Dash 5 amendments speak to, at the end of the IDA savings period, the money would have to be expended. The problem is that if you want to start an IDA account for a young person or for someone who's not ready to go to college at that time, that money would need to have been expended. So what we can do with a college savings program or plan is roll the money over from the match and from the individual so that the $2,000 that you've saved and the $2,000 match go into two separate accounts into the Oregon College Savings Plan. You can continue to save. You're not matched, but you can continue to save and receive tax benefits to the time when you, your child, or someone, your beneficiary, can go to school. So this allows to extend the benefits, allow individuals to continue to save, and extends basically an educational IRA, which they've not had access to.
Right. Now, you mentioned something about home purchases.
There are three things that you can use an IDA for. You can use it for a purchase of a first-time home, and you can use it for capitalization of a business. These are three things, education, home ownership, and business, which are considered asset building and things that move people out of poverty permanently. A lot of times we have worked with individuals by helping support their income. Well, this builds their assets.
All right. Now, can this money that we're talking about through these amendments be rolled over into a purchase of a home or the capitalization of a business?
There are no savings vehicles, long-term asset-building vehicles for capitalization of a business that this is eligible to work with. For home, it could be rolled over into an IRA. We have not made an amendment to state that specifically because there was some question whether, technically speaking, can this asset-building program from the state of Oregon be done to do that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Further questions for Mr. Ball? Senator George?
I believe you said two amendments, or your Dash 3 and 5?
We had submitted a Dash 3 and a Dash 4. That came out of Legislative Council with some
problems.
So your support is for
Dash 3 and Dash 5.
Okay. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Senator.
Further questions for Mr. Bowen?
And the Dash 3, why are you wanting to go to $75,000?
One of the issues was Oregon was one of the first states to pass a tax credit. And we passed it 25 cents, as you know. And a number of other states have gone and done the same kind of work, passed Oregon tax credits for IDAs, and 25 cents did not work for them. Most of the other states around the country have had success at 75 cents on the dollar, $75,000, and we're trying to learn from those lessons.
Thanks.
Thank you, sir.
I call forward Representative Merkley. Good morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. State Representative Jeff Merkley. I'm really here just to offer philosophical support for the concept and for the details that have been worked out by Mr. Bull of the Enterprise Foundation. It's very important as we ponder programs to think about how we can help people help themselves, and that's one of the beautiful things about the IDA. If you don't save a dime, you don't get a dime. And I can tell you that the low-income families they're saving, this is extraordinarily hard work. We're talking about families who are saving $30 to $50 a month and just hoping their transmission doesn't go out on their car and wipe out a year's worth of effort. I had a newspaper article from two Sundays ago in the Oregonian about a family that after 10 years of saving, their children were not born when they started saving. This wasn't 10 years through the IDA, but the last couple of years were through the IDA, and they were able to buy a house in East Gresham. And it really talked about the fulfillment of their dream and that the IDA was a key component of them getting there. That's what we hope to see happen on a much larger scale. That family's home will probably become the way that they will be able to send their kids to college. It will modify the way they view the world because they will have a stake in the community. It will modify the way they view property, that it is something you value, you treasure, you can paint the rooms as you want. You are not simply a tenant in someone else's space. And so it's a good thing all the way around, and I commend the bill and the changes that have been brought forward.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. Any questions for the representative?
Hearing seen none. Thank you. I'd like to call forward Pam Levitt, Kent White, and Bruce Engel. They are representing disparate interests, but maybe we can conclude our deliberations on House Bill 3391.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Pam Levitt with the Credit Union Association of Oregon, and here with me is Kent White of Wood Products Credit Union in Springfield, Oregon. We just want to express our support for the IDA program. It matches very well with the philosophy of credit unions, of people helping people. We believe in any incentive to help individuals save for college, for first-time home buying, and we work extremely hard with our credit union members, especially our low-income members, and the IDA program matches very well. We have a couple credit unions in Oregon working with the IDA program. We hope to have more, and we're just here to express our support. I did not see the Dash 3 and a 5 amendments, but I do want to say that we are also working very hard to promote the Treasurer's College Savings Program. And we had an opening at Kent White's Credit Union in Beaverton, Oregon, and had 25 people sign up that day for a college savings plan at that opening. And so we're going to work hard because we believe it's another great program. So thank you.
Any questions? Senator Minnis.
And do are credit unions nonprofits that can facilitate this? Or
we would hold the member would build their savings, the one working with IDAs in the credit union. So.
How do people know about IDAs?
Well, I'm just learning about them myself, and I think our credit unions are also. If you look at the back of my testimony, I gave you some information from the federal level. It's one of the top priorities, I think it's promoted through, you know, I think Robert could probably answer that more, but promoted through public agencies and through programs where these people are offering. We certainly don't promote it very well at credit unions, unless Kent wants to address that.
As it stands right now, it's still in its infancy in mm-hmm. terms of getting financial institutions partnered up with IDAs. However, we've recently entered a partnership down in Roseburg with an IDA program, and what we're doing is we're coordinating the publicity and public education efforts between the various organizations that are associated with the IDA, with the credit union, and with the other financial partners. So you have community banks, credit unions, not-for-profit organizations all working together to help recruit people who can participate in this program and let them know just exactly how it works. So it's really the task of the folks that are involved in this program to make sure that it's well-publicized.
I think the obvious implication of the question for me was that perhaps there should be more done to publicize the program. It seems like an excellent better way to equity.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Yes. In my testimony, I talked about a roundtable that I recently had, and credit unions are offering, you know, free seminars to all their members in the evening. And one CEO told me they expect, you know, when you all have your town hall meetings, you never know if 2 or 5 people or 20 people are going to show up. They had one night 150 people show up for a meeting that the credit union held for free just to learn about investing and savings and first-time home buying. And so I think people are interested, and we do try to hold those free seminars.
Thank you.
Mr.
Engel, welcome. Good morning.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm a member of the Klamath Tribes. I'm a loan officer having a specialty in business credit with Warm Springs Tribes. And I do housing credit. I've also worked with USDA Rural Development in single-family housing. I managed the Medford office that handled most of the Southern Oregon area a couple of years ago. I am here speaking in support of the IDA program, in support of 75% as far as the tax credit, because that makes more money available to help more people. I have seen the results of an IDA program. We're getting one going over at Warm Springs. We're working with a national organization. We have already one of our people who worked with COCAN, and she has moved into a home, a new home, within the last 4 months. She got her credit situation squared away. She has 3 children. She is now a homeowner, and she worked for it. It wasn't easy. That matching money was essential. And what I'm asking or is the consideration that the investment that is made now yields a benefit that is long-term, that is many-fold, that is multi-generational and multicultural. And I would further ask that Indian tribes be included, because it is my understanding that they have not yet been included in this legislation. I had a term thrown at me just at the beginning of the session here that an amendment in concept was a possibility. I have to throw that out and then duck for cover because I don't know any more than that about it.
Actually, conceptual amendments cause the chairs and the members to duck and roll, but that doesn't stop us from doing so. The question is only, conceptual amendments are generally very clear, very concise, one or two word changes. And I guess I would have to ask bringers of the Dash A5 amendments whether there is an area that tribes could be included without wrenching the concept of a conceptual amendment. Senator Miss?
I just wanted to ask, in what sense are you talking about Indian tribes being included? I mean, it seems to me that if there's a community bank or a nonprofit credit union that services an Indian population, that they might be able to access this program via that medium. But
we do not yet have a community bank down there. We are working to set up the IDA program, and I think I would appeal to Rob to come up here and help me.
There's been a lifeline thrown from the guidelines by Mr. Bowles. And actually, Senator, I think the tribes do qualify as a fiduciary organization, but maybe Mr. Bowles can shed some light on that.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Chair, my understanding is from that if a IDA, that the monies can be held in a fiduciary organization, which could be a tribally designated bank. However, if a tribally designated nonprofit wanted to start IDAs for their members, that has not been designated in because of the, like the tribally designated housing entity, which is a typical organization within a tribe to work with its members. I guess one thing I would suggest, and maybe what we could do is work, if it goes to conference committee, work on an amendment at that point rather than allowing you not to duck and roll for the concept amendment.
Well, if this bill passes out of this committee with amendment, then we could request the chair of the House committee, and I believe that would be Representative Shetterly, not to concur initially. To allow that amendment to be brought, it could be brought at that point.
It's a very small technical amendment, and I think that could be we could do.
Mr. Senator Minnis,
just a suggestion: if Legislative Council is listening, it might be possible to set this over and see if they can draft an amendment quickly, rather than mucking around with the conference committee. If it's a simple technical amendment, you need somebody who knows which relevant statutes to go to amend.
Mr. Chair. Speaking with Representative Merkley as he was walking in talking about this, he said he'd be happy to take care of that.
Well, he's not here.
You're saying you can stay the step?
I'm saying you can stay the step if you call down the Legislative Council, get the right certified smart lawyer up here who might be able to put it together.
Isn't that oxymoron?
I didn't say that. You did. It's just a thought. We do have other business, don't we?
Well, we do, and as a matter of fact, almost regardless of what we do today, we'll be in session next Thursday. Yeah. So we could easily set this over and take action at that time. The chair would be happy to ask the Legislative Council to draft an amendment that would add the tribal interests, if that's what you would prefer, and actually it probably be a 15-minute conversation. Sometime today, if you could get on the Legislative Council's agenda to do that. I don't know if Mr. Ball would be willing to assist with that process, but certainly I would expect Mr. Engel to be willing to do that.
I'd be more than willing to do anything I can to help.
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to help out, too.
Perhaps what we'll do is just go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 3391 with the understanding that we'll bring the bill back to the committee at our first next scheduled opportunity. Question, Senator Miss?
Yes, We've got one of those certified smart lawyers in the room here.
I felt the pressure wave.
Intellectual wave. Kind of, yeah.
The charge in the room changed.
Words.
Intellectual.
Did I not pronounce it right?
Look at your own.
Would you like to come forward? Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Mr. Johnson, let's say council office.
Mr. Johnson, I'm going to make an assumption that a technical change can be easily accomplished, but it would still require a bit of research on your part to make sure that the tribal institutions fit the definitions in the bill as fiduciary institutions, et cetera. The issue before the committee is how do we, at the request of Mr. Engel, representing tribal interests, how do we include the tribal institutions so that they might participate in the benefits of this program?
Mr. Chair, I think the answer to that is to, in the Individual Development Account statute, change the definition of fiduciary organization to include a reference to the appropriate tribal
A relatively simple change, but one that still requires a little bit of research.
Yes, I would need to figure out how to reference that tribal organization.
Okay. So I think the proper thing to do would be to bring the bill back after Mr. Johnson's had a chance to do the proper research, and we'll make the request formally from the chair for those amendments to be prepared, and that saves a step yet again. Thank you, Mr. Johnson, for being attentive to our meeting. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3391.
We'll
move to House Bill 2555. Representative Butler, would you please come forward?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Tom Butler from House District 60. Did you want legislative revenue staff to introduce?
We'd have just a brief orientation to 2555 from legislative staff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Butler. House Bill 2555 reduces the income tax rate on net long-term capital gains derived from liquidation of assets used in farming. It sets this reduced rate at 5%, provided that the farm is essentially going out of business. This would become available beginning 2002 tax year.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator George.
All of your legislators who are in the building will have to declare a conflict of interest, because every farmer is at risk right now. We may need to use this. Yes, sir. As a matter of fact, I thought all farms and ranches were continuously going out of business.
I thought that was a habit that's gone on for years, Senator Byer.
Senator Butler, or Representative Butler, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm honored to be with you today.
I think we're in public hearing. We are now in public hearing on 2555.
Thank you.
For the bill, Representative Butler.
Thank you again. Colleagues, members of the Senate, I'm honored to be with you today and honored to present to you House Bill 2555, which basically is a baby step towards, again, the reconnect of the Oregon back with the federal. It doesn't fully reconnect us, but it does make this one baby step to level the playing field relative to our farmers. The farming and ranching community is in that unique position where we're about at the same prices that we were getting anywhere from 25 to 35 years ago in many of the commodities. And these are once-in-a-lifetime activities when we dispose of farms. Typically, the farms are being disposed of. Unfortunately, they're moving outside of the farm and ranch community to third hands, and there's nothing we can do to stop that. Frequently, the proceeds are used more to pay state tax than they are to pay the creditors off, and the state tax has been at a much higher rate. Excuse me. Now, if these were corporate farms, and that were liquidating out, and there were a family corporation that was liquidating its family corporate farm, the corporate tax rate would be 6.6%, and this would reduce it to 5%. whereas to an individual, it would be reducing the tax rate to 5% from a maximum of 9%. And because of Oregon's very steep graduation to a 9% rate after you've earned $10,000 or $12,000 gross, the 9% is typically the rate that is being charged. And I gave by way of example in the House a particular widow whose husband passed away in Oregon. We do not have the step-up in basis of the property as to the widow's one-half, only as to the deceased's one-half of the property. And in the instant case that I gave in the House side was that following after the machinery and equipment had been sold and disposed of and she would finish out the year and after the place was sold, the capital gains rate that had actually been paid to the state was nearly as much money as had been paid on the total federal, the federal starting at zero going to 20% maximum, which is just right at half of the upper limit. The maximum upper limit presently is 39.6. And so the 20% is the maximum rate on the federal. And so there is a rather significant capital gains break on the federal. We have no such break on the state of Oregon. And so, again, what this does is this limits the play, or it levels the playing field, and it's a limited activity. This reduced rate is only, typically we would see it happen as a farmer or rancher disposed of their operation, a once-in-a-lifetime kind of an operation. It doesn't mean that they couldn't go back into farming again in the next generation if they chose to do so. I like to use the example, people say, well, are any of your children accountants? Two accountants that get married ought to have children that are accountants. You know, accountants are an industry. We do not reproduce. We're almost sterile relative to producing accountants. Doctors produce doctors and nurses, and lawyers produce lawyers. But do you know
when an extrovert accountant and an introvert accountant is?
They just don't reproduce.
The extrovert accountant looks at your shoes instead of his own?
Right.
Okay.
I need to visit with you about that. Your story
you need to visit with your wife. You don't need to visit with me.
But the amazing thing is that in farming...
Representative Butler, that is why this committee will end with a whimper and not a bang.
Oh!
I'm sorry.
In farming, it's very seldom that you'll find someone that's new to farming. I mean, it's almost an unknown. So farms are passed down from generation to generation, farm family to farm family, and typically what we're finding is with the prices and with the commodities and all of those kinds of things that we're finding that farmers really can't pass on from one generation to the next now these farming operations. And again, because of what's happened with regard to the commodity prices, the tax on the gain, if the farm was bought for $50,000 40 years ago and is worth $500,000 today, the $50,000 worth of purchasing power versus the $500,000 worth of purchasing power is about the same thing. The problem that we've got is that by the time we're done paying the taxes on it, we end up with just a fraction of the $500,000 left. And if we could show that the farmer had been the one that had created all of that inflation during the years through his commodities and through his prices, then I could see the reason why we would want to penalize them. But again, this is a baby step towards the Reconnect. It allows these farms to be sold and enjoy a basically once-in-a-lifetime reduction. And I don't want to call it a once-in-a-lifetime because if they won the lottery the next year, and they could get in and start farming until it was all gone, this would give them an opportunity to get back in and start farming again. But this would give them an opportunity to liquidate their farming assets at a reduced capital gains rate of 5% versus 6.6 being a corporation or versus a 9% maximum rate for the individual.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Any questions for Representative Butler? We're going to call Mr. Schellenberg forward, who is also asked to testify for this bill, and then...
not an accountant, is he?
Senator, Representative Butler, you may wish to stand ready to answer any further questions, but we're going to go to work session on this bill just as soon as Mr. Schellenberg offers his testimony on this bill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. With that very nice word of encouragement, I would simply urge your passage of the bill.
Questions for Mr. Schallenberg? And seeing none. We're in work session on House Bill 2555.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Vice Chair.
Move House Bill 2555 to the floor with it be passed.
The chairman, the vice chairman has moved House Bill 2555 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Are there questions, objections to the motion? So ordered. Mr. Vice Chair, well, we need a carrier for this bill. Probably somebody that knows something about farming. Senator Stark will carry the bill. Thank you. Close the work session on House Bill 2555. Colleagues, this is the little bill that won't go away. What we need to do is ask for a rule suspension to reconsider the Dash 1 amendments on Senate Bill 61, which were intended to be removed from the bill before we amended it with Dash 4s, and you did not do that. So the chairman will go into work session on the chairman will request a motion for the suspension of rules to reconsider the Dash 1 amendments on Senate Bill 61. Motion's on the floor. From the vice chair, any questions to the motion? So ordered. We're in work session on Senate Bill 61 for the express purpose of reconsidering the Dash 1 amendment.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Minnis?
We have to reconsider the vote by which we sent it to the floor.
You have to do that also. I have to suspend the rules, and then we have to reconsider the motion by which...
So moved.
Thank you. the motion is to reconsider the vote by which we sent the amended version of Senate Bill 61 to the Committee on Public Affairs. Any questions about the motion? Any objections to the motion? So ordered. Now we need a motion to...
Chair, move that the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 61 be removed.
The motion is to remove the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 61. Any questions on the motion? Objections to the motion? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, move that Senate Bill 61, as amended, be moved to the Committee on Public Affairs with the draft.
The motion is to move Senate Bill 61 as amended to the Committee on Public Affairs with a due pass recommendation. Yes, Senator Minnis?
I just objected.
Senator Minnis will be recorded as an objection. Any further objections? So ordered. Work session on Senate Bill 61.
We're done with that.
Right now. Yeah. what a great little bill. Okay, we are in our, actually, colleagues, we are in consideration of the last bill on our agenda this morning, Senate Bill 764. So we'll ask for the appropriate orientation.
The last bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 764 is the bill we had before us a couple of times now to extend the sunset of the pollution control tax credit for 6 additional years. We also have several amendments that came in this morning, Dash 4, Dash 5, and Dash 6. The Dash 4 amendments appear to allow an additional 3-year carry forward for unexpired pollution control tax credits. Under current law, there's a 3-year carry forward. This would allow an additional 3 years if certain conditions are met. The Dash 5 amendments allow taxpayers engaged in agricultural plastics recycling activities to sell pollution control tax credits.
Excuse me, the committee members may not have any of the Dash amendments, so we'll have those distributed before we go further. Thank you. Jeez, they're still warm. plenty of seating in the side aisles, gentlemen and ladies and gentlemen.
Why is everybody so interested in this bill?
Yeah, what an expectant looking crowd.
Haven't seen you guys all session.
Maybe again, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please do.
The Dash 4 amendments allow an additional 3-year carry forward for unexpired pollution control tax credits. In current law, there is a 3-year carry forward. This would extend that for 3 additional years if certain conditions are met. Dash 5 amendments allow taxpayers engaged in agricultural plastics recycling to sell pollution control tax credit or unused pollution control tax credits to another taxpayer. The Dash 6 amendments require contractors who are working on certified pollution control facilities be designated as responsible contractors by Construction Contractors Board.
Questions on the orientations to amendment? Yes, Senator Turner.
What is an agricultural plastic recycler? What are they doing?
Actually, I think that's the twine and sacking, and apparently there's quite a serious problem with
the
twine. Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
So what they do is recycle those things, and we're trying to incent that stuff off of farmland. We are in work session on Senate Bill 764. Vice Chair.
Just a comment before I move some of these. We're at that point in the session when things move forward. They're not quite finally baked. This particular bill, as I think everybody knows, is in the mix, is in negotiation between the governor's office and the leadership, both parties, both houses, and their request has been that we move the bill to get it over to the House, recognizing, frankly, that whatever we move out of here today will have to come back in a concurrence with and will probably there's little relationship to what we're dealing with here. This is moving the bill along. The two amendments that have been agreed that we would put in, the Dash 4s were requested by Georgia Pacific, and the Dash 5s was a recycling idea that we discussed last time this was up. Those are the two that remind me. Dash 6s are somebody else's. I don't know those.
I'll be moving those.
Okay. So, just the truth in moving here, what's going on. Well, Mr. Chair, I would move the Dash 4 amendments to 764.
The motion is to move the Dash 4 amendments to Senate Bill 764. Are there any questions on the motion? Objections to the motion? Anything then?
So ordered.
Move the Dash 5 amendments to 764.
Dash 5 amendments have been moved by the Vice Chair. Are there any questions on the motion? Any objections to the motion? So ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
Move the Dash 6 amendments, and if possible, I'd like Mr. Shiprock to come up and explain the reasons for inserting those.
Mr. Shiprock, would you please come forward?
It's a very interesting story, Mr. Chair. It is.
I hope interesting and brief. Mr. Shiprock, welcome.
I got the message. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Bob Shiprock, Executive Secretary of the Oregon Building and Construction Trades Council. We're offering the Dash 6 amendments today to address some problem that we experience in the construction of some of the facilities. It's been a longstanding public policy in Oregon and in most other states and certainly the federal government that when public funds are used for capital improvement projects, that certain responsibilities are put on to those individuals or companies or public agencies, whatever, that take those public funds. These tax credits, if not used in this fashion, would go to the state general fund. These are dollars that are paid in by individuals into the state general fund. There are public funds that are used for these capital improvements. And what we're trying to do here is extend some type of a broader public policy on the use of public funds on the construction of these facilities. It's very damaging on, and oftentimes in rural areas when there is a capital construction improvement project spent or paid for by these tax credits, to have out-of-state contractors, out-of-state workers brought in. The project is funded with our tax dollars, and the money leaves the state. What the intent of the Dash 6 amendments are is that there would be some policy directed toward the use of these public funds, that a better opportunity for those dollars would be spent by Oregon for Oregon employers and for Oregon workers. That's what it's about. And again, it extends the public policy we've got in many other statutes. I'd be happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chair.
Senator Corcoran, then Senator Minnis.
Mr. Shiprock, would you tell us about what you observed or what was observed in terms of the construction of one of the plants that brought this concern to you in the first place, license plates?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Corcoran, I didn't want to personalize this morning.
You can generalize it.
I would just say that it is, there have been instances in this state where out-of-state workers and employers, typically from southeast part of the country, have come into Oregon. Several years ago, I happened to work on a plant that I believe is now closed. I'll just say the Gardner Paper Mill.
Representative, Mr. Shiprock, can I just interrupt your testimony for a moment?
Sure.
We have an honored guest who is in the committee room today. Governor Attia is here, and I imagine he is here to help celebrate the designation of the week honoring Native American tribes in Oregon. But we're honored by your presence, sir. Thank you. Please proceed, Mr. Shiprock.
This particular plant I went down on, and some famous contractors from the southeast part of the country were there. They had flown in all their workers, put them up in local establishments. It's interesting, and as a side, they had the microphones that go through the whole plant, and they get on there and their harmonicas and play Dixie. I thought that was interesting, but there have been other examples where we have observed the license plates of folks going into these plants, and again, I don't want to personalize it, but there is a problem out there. I'm trying to stay on the high road today with the public policy of using tax dollars, Oregon taxpayer dollars, in this case, private improvements, and extending that policy. But it's a big deal in rural areas. If you've got a big project like this in rural areas and you don't get anything out of it, or very little, it's pretty devastating on a community. I've seen it.
Senator Miss?
Mr. Shiprock, why are you including prevailing wage rate language here?
Because, Mr. Chairman, Senator Minnis, that's typically one of the policies that has been extended through public contracting laws where there are public funds being used. It is a minimal. The time constraints, I won't go into it. That is not to say, and for the benefit of the committee, those rates are established today by region, 14 regions around the state, certified by the Bureau of Labor and Industries. We survey over 1 million hours of work annually, and those rates are established, and they are established in order to established the area standard wages and fringe benefits in 14 areas around the state. So that is, in fact, what the area standard wages and fringes are, as determined by the Bureau of Labor.
Again, doesn't that generally apply to public projects?
Yes, it does.
Wouldn't these projects be being accomplished by private industry?
The owners are private individuals. The source of the funding, however, is public. That's my point. It's much similar to...
Does the tax credit cover the entire cost?
I can't answer that question. However, Mr. Chairman, it's typical where there is, in current law, where there is any expenditure of public funds, then public contracting laws and prevailing wage would apply. I think it's also somewhat analogous to where we use lottery funds for economic development, perhaps even helping private corporations. Those dollars currently under public contract laws and prevailing wage as well.
Can staff tell us what percentage the job covers in terms of total project cost?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, the credit is 50% of the certified construction cost.
Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to support this amendment if we increase it to 100%.
Thank you, Mr. Minnis. Senator Minnis. I don't think that's within our ability to do with this bill.
Anything legislative council can write, we can do it. It may not survive.
True enough. Questions? Other questions for Mr. Shiprock? Further questions for Mr. Shiprock? Hearing and seeing none. Actually, we have, since we have opened this line of invited testimony, I'd like to bring Mr. Cravens forward to have him testify also.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Jim Craven from the American Electronics Association. I'm going to testify briefly on the Dash 6s, which I've just seen, though we have seen these in various rooms around the Capitol over the last several weeks on various issues. Let me just clarify one reason why, and I'm not going to speak to the policy discussion as to the mechanics. Unlike other issues where we expend public funds, we're going to go out, we're going to build a new building here on the Mall, and we have prevailing wage laws, and we have a set of public funds that's sitting in the Treasury. We're going to go out and let bids. We're going to hire people to spend public funds to build something for us. It's a lot easier in that situation to say, before we do that work, we're going to go make sure we have responsible contractors, certify. Everybody knows up front they're going to be subject to prevailing wage and those kinds of terms. In a pollution control tax credit situation, I just want to let you know that you don't even apply, because this says prior to submitting an application for certification. That's the trigger in these amendments. You don't apply for a pollution control tax credit till you're done with the work. The company, using its purely private capital and using whatever contractors it decides to engage for the work, goes out and spends $1-3 million rehabbing an air scrubber on top of an industrial facility. Does that work, completes the work. The law actually says substantial completion. You have to be done with your work. At that point, then you start the paperwork to apply for a pollution control tax credit. You send the paperwork into DEQ. You engage in a very extensive discussion about how much of the costs were pollution control versus other things that you were going to do otherwise for the plant. You go through this accounting process. You determine the value of the pollution part of that thing. And then if DEQ and the commission approves the application, they certify 50% that you then, in a subsequent year, claim as a tax credit. So there's a real substantial problem in the triggering mechanism here. Despite the issue of public policy, I'm not sure how this would even work, since it's not an issue of public funds sitting in the Treasury. We're going to go hire a contractor to spend public funds, and we're going to make sure that they're certified, responsible, prevailing wage, and all that. This is something where purely private capital spends the money, finishes the project, and then hopes it gets a tax credit if it can convince DEQ that the work followed all the rules and the law. So that's just an issue about how the program actually works. So I'm not sure how you do this. You would, before you even did the project, you'd go get certified, you'd go through all these triggers, pay prevailing wage and do all this, and maybe not even get a credit at the other end, because the credit gets certified after the work is done.
So, Mr. Chair?
Senator Kirkland.
So then, Mr. Cravens, would you consider amending the amendment to say that you can't apply for the tax credit unless you've used responsible contractors?
Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, I suspect that my clients would oppose that amendment, not having had a chance to chat with anybody about this. I don't want to say that up front, but I think it's just the ex post facto nature as that policy applies to this, as opposed to other things where you're going to start something, you know the rules of the road. So you basically what you would be saying is that going back sometimes 2-3 years worth of effort, all the subcontractors you use to rehab your industrial facility, going back and finding out whether you had in fact followed all these rules, and if you hadn't, then you'd be out of luck.
Mr. Chairman? Senator George?
My understanding of this, and correct me if I'm wrong, that one of the reasons for this credit is that we're trying to get industry to go beyond the absolute requirement. In other words, to clean up the air, clean up the water beyond what would they absolutely expected by EPA and DEQ. Is there that kind of characteristic to the incentive program, or am I just wrong on that?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, there is oftentimes that characteristic in individual project. It is not, however, a legal requirement. It's not required that you exceed standards in order to be eligible. In my anecdotal, talking to the clients I represent, indeed, that's often the case, in that when an individual plant manager has to argue for capital internally, mm-hmm. plant manager says to his accountant, her accountant, we need to do this pollution control thing to rehab the facility. I could buy something for X amount of dollars and just squeak by and meet the standards that DEQ and EPA have set. With this pot sweetener, with mm-hmm. essentially it's a pot sweetener, I would like to go above and beyond, and by throwing this financial incentive into the mix, in many cases that's indeed what they do. They over-design because public partnership and helping to absorb some of that cost.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Mulgrew,
this is more of a statement than a question. I believe that to be the case, that with an incentive, a person is going to look beyond absolute requirement, maybe anticipating further additional requirement in the future, something like that. Well, let me ask you this question. If you add substantial cost to your effort, are you going to make that, or are you going to just actually go for the minimum? To me, the incentive would be there, cut for the minimum. I've got additional cost because of the program now has all of the Dash 6 requirements.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, I just absolutely agree. And I have a number of environmental managers at companies that I represent who've told me exactly that, that the net perverse result that may result from doing away with the pollution control tax credit in Oregon is that we may get less environmental protection because of the financial book balancing may do the minimum rather than going above and beyond.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
So the net perverse effect of this may be that people don't do this in the future, but the net perverse tax incentive now is they can do it and get away with it. That's rational? That's what the public
policy. Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, I'm not sure what you mean, do it and get away with it.
To bring in out-of-state workers to no benefit at all to the state at all and then give a tax credit. That's good public policy?
Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, I have not even reviewed this issue of out-of-state contractors with my clients, so I don't have a response to that.
Colleagues, we're in a work session on the bill. The Dash 6 amendments have been moved. We had kind of a point-counterpoint discussion. I think we're ready to take the vote. Any further discussion from the committee?
Can we ask if, so you don't want any more comments on any of these amendments from the audience, because I know there's probably other people out there who would like to weigh in on some of these things.
Well, the bill is scheduled for work session, okay. So it's invited commentary only.
Okay.
But I guess just speaking as the chairman, the Dash 4 amendments have been something that has been a concept in play on the bill since it was framed. Dash 5 was, I think, drafted 420. Is that correct, Ed? Yeah. So they've been around quite a while, at least for the consideration of the committee and others. The Dash 6 amendments are only lately come. I'm not at all sure how they fit within or if they fit within the framework of negotiations. The members who are considering the bill know very well the interests that are arrayed around this bill, and some of them, in fact, have representation or represent some of the same interests that bring the Dash 6. So the point is, if the Dash 6 concept is to be in play, I'm sure that there's ample opportunity in immediately following this action to either get them in or get them out as a concept. So my inclination is not to see the Dash 6 amendments moved. I'll be voting against them. But we have the motion on the floor, and I think, you know, further discussion from the committee, I think we just take the vote. Yes, Mr. Vice Chair.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Normally, the Dash 6 are something I would be inclined to look favorably on, but as I said when I made my initial comments on this, this thing has been in play for a while, and it is in the midst of negotiations between the governor's office and the legislative leadership. I suspect that the Dash 6 will be something that will be considered, but they're not part of the issue that was there, and so I'm not going to support them this morning. I wouldn't be surprised if they come back in the bill when we see it for the second time, which I'm pretty sure we'll either see it for the second time or the thing will sunset completely.
And I think, you know, all fairness, perhaps it was the lateness of the hour of the Dash 6. But notwithstanding that, I think the committee deserves better information than failed references to out-of-state workers in terms of commentary. I, like many of those who represent...
We had a lot of comments on the effectiveness of the pollution control tax credit in the first place.
We have
I don't understand why that would be a problem.
Senator, I guess if I could finish, the issue for me is I'm very interested in stimulating any local employment, especially in rural areas. Very interested in doing that. And if there's a compelling case for the public policy to get local contracting, I would very much like to see that concept explored. But I suggest that the time for that may be yet in the future, but given the length of time this committee's known this bill is coming, it seems to me we could have heard about that concept well before this. Anyway, let's go ahead. If there's no other commentary from the committee, let's go ahead and call the roll on this one.
Voting on the Dash 6.
Dash 6 amendments. Is the motion was made by Senator Corcoran to amend the bill with the Dash 6 amendments. Any questions on the motion? For the comments, let's call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
No.
No.
No. No. Dash 6 amendments are not incorporated in the bill. We need a motion to move the bill.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Vice Chair.
Move Senate Bill 764 as amended to the floor with a due pass.
The motion is to move Senate Bill 764 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Questions on the motion?
Mr. Chair, I don't have a question. I guess I'd just like to make a comment before we vote on this. I'm going to be voting no. There may be some negotiations happening behind the scenes, but I really feel like, you know, that the issues that have been raised really have not been addressed adequately in this arena, in the committee arena, such as the fact that, as we just heard Mr. Craven say, that there is nothing in the law that requires companies to exceed federal standards in order to get this, which I think is a huge issue in these times of very difficult budgets. And we also know that our state has by far the most generous pollution control tax credit in the country at a time when we're looking at cutting, you know, school-based health clinics and programs to seniors and a lot of other things that we're looking at, and I just I just question whether we can afford to do all of that. And while there may be some negotiations underway, I certainly hope that the end result addresses all of those issues. And until that's happened, I'm going to be a no.
Thank you, Senator. Further commentary? Senator Moon?
Chairman, I just want to say I have no problem with the Dash 6 amendments if they were amended to structurally fit within the context of the application for permits and so on and so forth, as long as the state pays 100% of these costs. I think it's inappropriate to include a provision requiring prevailing wage where the state is not picking up the entire cost of those projects.
Further comments from the committee? From my perspective, the we have heard from the beginning of orientation in the Senate Revenue Committee that Oregon is perhaps disproportionately dependent on manufacturing for its income, and that rather than diversification away from natural resource manufacturing, farm products and forest products, we diversified into high-tech manufacturing, and that, in fact, we are reminded often is now the economic engine of the state of Oregon. So we do have a concurrent fact, and that is that Oregon's economy is lagging significantly behind other regional economies when compared with states in the Pacific Northwest and in the Western region. And I believe now that anything that we can do to help incent health in that sector, the manufacturing sector, is probably long-term going to provide more jobs, more opportunity, more revenue for the general fund. So, you know, I don't disagree with the public policy issue at all. I'd love to see more incenting of employment in local communities by good-paying family wage jobs. I have to agree, in a sense, with Senator Minnison that we're trying to incent an action by business that goes beyond the issue of mere compliance. I think that may be the part of the closure that you're looking for, mm-hmm. Senator. So,
we'll help you with that in the minority report, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Kirkman. I'll look forward to it. With that said, let's go ahead and conclude our actions on this bill.
No.
Nope.
Aye.
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 Aye. Aye. Motion passes. That closes the work session on Senate Bill 764. And, the Vice Chair will carry the bill. Ordered. That's also besides one other action that we need to take. I believe concludes our business for today, but I'd ask the members to remain seated if you don't mind. Senator Minnison, you pass out the rest of the government, please.
I don't actually have plenty of time.
Ape is for money. Thanks, Ron. Senator Corcoran, you may want to soak yours in gasoline.
All right.
The that's fine. Senator George. Senator Byron. Senator Corcoran. Senator Starr. It is. Senators, if you don't mind, we'll go ahead and close the record, but for the record, I'd like to say that working with you on this committee has been an adventure. It's been a challenge. I'd like to say to the all the members of the committee that serving on revenue is not an easy task. I don't know of another committee where the philosophical issues clash as directly as they do as on this committee. But I've appreciated working with all of you, and I've come to understand why anyone who's ever served on revenue is reluctant to ever do it again. But in any case, I've really appreciated the work that you've done here, and we will be back to consider some other good bills. But in the meantime, I think I can say without reservation that every member brought everything that they had to bring in good faith to this committee, and I genuinely appreciate your service. That having been said, our committee is closed for, until reopened by order of the President.